On Monday, August 8th, Tall Can Audio hits 1,000 episodes.
Wait, that's still on? Who could possibly still care?
And the gang is all here to celebrate.
It's euphoric. It's got to be close to nirvana. It's outstanding.
For the first time ever, Maddie, Michaela, Rob, and Matt are all live in studio together.
It's happening, you guys! It's happening! Oh, my God, guys! Oh, my God! I wish you all were here!
Is this likely to go well?
Just check my notes here. No!
At least it will make a lot of noise.
Boom. Here comes the boom.
1,000 pods and 1,000 pints.
I don't think I've ever been as proud in my entire life.
TCA 1000 drops Monday, August 8th, wherever you find low-quality podcasts.
Fuck, it's out of control. Shit.
I'm not sure what the f*** this is. I'm about to find out.
This is Tall Can Audio.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome back into the Tall Can Audio podcast. My name's Matt Robinson. Make sure you are following along on Twitter and Instagram at Tall Can Audio, Facebook.com/Tall Can Audio. Make sure you're subscribed wherever you're listening to this one, whether it be Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, Spotify. We are everywhere at this point. Somewhere there is a follow button. There is a subscribe button. We hope you'll hit it, and we hope you'll enjoy this one. And on the show today, really excited to be welcoming back a friend of the show. I think this is your third time on now, Mike Comito. How you doing, man?
Doing great, Matt. Thanks for having me back. It's been a while.
Yeah, I think it's been about a year. I think you were on in the summer last time, and we talked about some of the more interesting things that, you know, dates maybe that I know that's what you specialize in is... is hockey history. Yeah. And so we touched on some of the more interesting summer dates, but how has the pandemic treated Mike Comito? What have you been keeping yourself busy with? How's the family doing? Everything good?
Yeah. I mean, I think as you and I kind of joked offline that it's going as well as could be expected. It's definitely been an interesting time for the Comito household. We welcomed our second daughter the day before, like everything shut down.
Oh, wow.
We brought her home on Monday morning, and then I went into work on Monday afternoon and told my staff that they should pack up their stuff because we were all going to be working from home. And I think at that point, you know, we weren't sure how long it would be. And, you know, Star Wipe 6 months later, you know, our staff is still working from home. My daughter's, you know, going to be 6 months old in a couple of weeks. You know, it's obviously been interesting on the hockey side of things, you know, with the season kind of being put on hiatus and then resuming with, you know, with the qualifiers in the postseason. A lot of the stuff that I was doing for the Kings and the Wolves kind of, you know, took a back seat until we kind of get a handle on when their seasons will resume. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've kept busy. I've been writing a book for the last little while now. I've been kind of quietly been doing that, but finally got the chance to announce the news a couple of weeks ago. So I figured that, you know, with things on hiatus with my work in the Kings, and the Wolves for at least the next little while, might as well try to bang out another book. And then hopefully by the time the book is done, the next NHL season resumes and we can get back to some of that Kings hockey history stuff.
So we're going to talk about the book. I got lots of questions about that. One of the things that has happened on this show over the course of the pandemic, and obviously our listeners know that most weeks Rob's in here and we'll try a different craft beer each time. And he hasn't been able to be in studio here, obviously, since the pandemic. We're doing our best, like everybody else, to social distance and this and that. So we've had a ton of guests and we've done pretty well here over the course of the thing. But I started getting feedback from listeners that we were starting to fade on the craft beer front. And I needed to start asking my guests if they were into that scene at all and what they might be up to. So I don't think in the first two times that you were on that I asked you about that. Are you a craft beer guy? And if so, what are some of your go-tos? What have you been into lately?
I am, for sure. Nice. I would say that I will, in the summertime, when it's hot out, I think my go-to is Muskoka Detour.
Oh, that's a nice one.
Yeah. But I'm also, you know, I have no problem, you know, guzzling down Land Sharks just because they're an easy... easy drinking beer. But I will say that on the weekend, I had my wife's family over and my father-in-law and I got into some Lake of Bays, which I think is always a good beer. So there was a couple new cans I hadn't seen before. So I just grabbed them when I was at the LCBO and they were good. They did the trick. So
there's something about Lake of Bays and it might just be the name itself. It paints a picture, right? You're like, oh, that sounds really nice. Like I'd like to be at the Lake of Bays. It's, there's just something about it.
I was in, we were in Huntsville last year for a little vacation. Went to Santa's Village, and the Muskoka Brewery is out that way. And I kid you not, I want to say it was the coldest beer I've ever had was from what they had on the taps there. So I don't know if it was because I was just happy to be on vacation, happy to be drinking a beer, you know, outside by a fire, or if legitimately it was very cold, but it felt like the coldest beer I've ever had, and it was fantastic.
Is there much of a scene in the Sudbury area where you're located there? Is there, you know, a couple of guys fired up, or, you know, what's the scene like up there?
Yeah, it's actually kind of, you know, in the last, I would say the last, like, probably 6-7 years, you know, we used to have northern breweries, you know, back in the day, which when I was growing up, you know, it wasn't necessarily because it was craft beer, it was because they used to do these things called draft balls. And it was like we used to call them beer spheres because it would be like, it was the equivalent of 6 cases of beer, that came in this sphere, and you would put a keg pump on it, like you would with a standard keg. And they were nice because like they came in a box, so you could fill the box with ice. But by the end of the evening, obviously all the ice would melt and the box would turn into this, you know, this soupy mess that you'd have to take care of afterwards. Right. But they were hilarious because they were cheap. So, you know, when you were in high school, university, you know, you can get a couple guys together, and it wasn't too bad to buy a beer sphere.
Right.
But you know, in the last little while, Stack Brewery has opened in Sudbury, which has been great. They do a lot of fantastic stuff. If you watch Letterkenny, they're the brewers for the show, and they were selling that for a while now. I think Letterkenny's got somebody else that's, you know, brewing those beers for them, so they don't use Stack anymore for that. But it's been nice. We've got another brewery that opened up on the same little strip, 46 North, and then there's also a distillery in town now. So it's definitely kind of taken an uptick in the last few years, which is awesome to get a little more variety in town.
I didn't tell you that I was going to ask you about this, so this might be springing it on you a little bit, but I know you do some work with the Sudbury Wolves. We talked not too long ago on this show about kind of the beauty of the old barn, right? And what you lose when you build something new. We were talking at that point specifically about the Peterborough Memorial Center and the push there to get a new building built, what happened in Oshawa and across the league, that some of these old barns are kind of coming to the end of their life cycle and something new's coming down the line. And obviously there's significant uptick that comes with that, and it's a great thing, but whether or not you lose something, am I correct? They're building a new building right now, or is it already open in Sudbury?
No. So it's actually a very contentious debate here in Sudbury about the site of the new arena. So the current owner of the Sudbury Wolves has a spot of land out kind of away from the downtown.
Yeah, it's
core.
Just outside of town, right? Is that what?
Yeah. And so he's hoping to develop that area. A lot of folks in town are not a fan of that idea because it would be taking the arena away from the downtown core and essentially building on the outskirts of town where there's not a lot of, you know, utilities out there. It's not really, you know, connected with the rest of the city. And so it's gone through, you know, several very contentious reviews at city council. It's now being reviewed provincially. I know that initially when this idea was first hatched a few years ago, the plan was hopefully to be playing in that arena by the 50th anniversary season, which is 2022-23. But given the fact that they haven't really made it official as to what they're going to do with it yet, I can't imagine that they're going to make that deadline.
Right.
But yeah, it's an interesting one because again, I'm in terms of the arena downtown, like the Sudbury Arena has been, that was built in 51.
Right.
And I think definitely like it's one of those interesting things for me, whereas, you know, if anyone who's ever been to the Sudbury Arena, you know, one of the things that I think anyone who's ever been to a Wolves game would tell you is that they've got this mangy, you know, taxidermic wolf that hangs on this wire. And every time the Wolves score a goal, somebody up in the booth presses a button and the wolf goes out across the ice on this wire. And now it kind of goes right above the visitor's bench and kind of just mocks them and the howling is going on. And then it retracts back to its little like corner of the arena. And so it's definitely this kitschy thing. When they first opened, you know, the arena back, you know, in the 50s and 60s, they didn't have it on a wire. They had it just kind of above the ice and it would kind of come out of this trap door. But then when the Wolves joined the OHA in 72, they had it on a clothesline and they would have kids who would go get to watch games for free. They would sit in a lawn chair in the corner of the arena, and every time they'd score, they'd have to like hustle the clothesline out to get the wolf over. So it's one of those things for me where I see like you can't possibly not have that in the Sudbury Wolves arena because it's become such a part of the team's identity and its heritage, but it will look kind of hilarious when you have the state-of-the-art facility wherever it ends up getting built, if it gets built, while all the while having this old mangy taxidermic wolf kind of patrolling the rafters.
Come down to this beautiful HD screen in the middle of the ice or something. Yeah,
exactly.
These are the things that we were talking about on that show is the, you know, it, no doubt if they get something new built up there, it'll be gorgeous. It'll be beautiful. It'll be state of the art. It'll be all these things. But you do feel like you're kind of losing a little bit of something, right? And there's something about going to the old barn and it just feels, it smells like hockey when you go in. It's kind of a combination of sweat and popcorn. And,
yeah.
And, you know, we've all kind of lost a lot of that. There's very few of those left in the OHL. And, you know, certainly Peterborough's hanging tough and it looks like Sudbury's getting ready to try to make a move. But, you know, do you have a take on that? Like in terms of, you know, what the excitement level should be or what kind of culturally we might lose when we make these sort of changes?
I mean, I think that at least, especially here in Sudbury, because of the issue around the location, I mean, I'm in the camp that I would like to see the arena stay downtown.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's not like my decision to make, but ultimately, I think we've seen some other examples, you know, with cities where, you know, arenas have been relocated, you know, back to the downtown core, and there's been a resurgence in activity, and it's obviously kind of, you know, connected to a lot of the, you know, the prosperity of those businesses downtown. But we've also seen the, you know, especially what the Ottawa Senators are doing right now, where they're trying to, you know, relocate back and all the problems associated that might have on the businesses out there. But also given the fact that it just probably makes more sense to be located downtown.
For sure.
We now have a potential option here to make the right choice and hopefully build it, which makes most sense for the community. But, you know, I think it's just, it's one of those things where you're going to lose a lot, I think, of the nostalgia for that building. Again, there's, you know, people going back, you know, generations watching the Wolves, you know, would have seen, you know, different iterations of the team play games there. Ultimately, you know, they've yet to win a championship. So, you know, they're hopefully, yeah, at some point, whatever, I would take whatever arena they're in, whether it's the old one or a refurbished one or a new one. Hopefully that all is tied to, you know, winning, you know, an OHL championship on the ice.
Yeah, and I was at the first game in the brand new General Motors Center when it opened for Oshawa. You know, as an Oshawa kid, I'd seen a pile of games at the Civic, and you know, by the time I was seeing games, it was a dive. Right? Like it was a, but you go to the GMC, you're like, man, like it's all brand spanking new, everything, and it felt every bit high end. But there's still a small party that's like, you know, it's just not quite the same. So I think this is one of those interesting debates that will carry on. I should ask before we get to a couple other things here, a substantial part of our listenership, big Ottawa Senators fans. And I know you have kept a very close eye on Quinton Byfield over the last little while. There's a pile of talk that, you know, he may end up going to, and this won't even be a thing that the Senators fans get to think about or worry about. But as a team that holds the number 3 pick, they're certainly keeping an eye on Quinton Byfield. I wonder what your impressions of that kid are in terms of how close to NHL ready he might be, what his strengths and weaknesses are, and for Sens fans, like what they might be looking at if he was to fall into their laps.
Yeah, no, and I mean, I think I'm of the mind where, again, as somebody who, you know, writes for both the Sudbury Wolves and the Los Angeles Kings, that
it's an interesting
I'd love to see this
there.
Conversation rendered moot by having the Kings take him at number 2, and then, you know, I can continue to write about Quinton Byfield, but from an LA Kings perspective.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's just a really exciting and dynamic player. Again, it's something where I think if you know, whether or not you've been following the Sudbury Wolves over the last, you know, 20 years or the franchise's entire history, that it's very rare that the Wolves have had a player like Quinton Byfield who's been able to do all the things he's had on the ice. And I think, you know, one of the things I always think about is obviously he's a big player and he just turned 18 years old. So he's almost a full year behind, you know, Alexis Lafreniere. So he's still got a lot of developing to do. He's only going to get, you know, bigger and stronger, which is only going to help, you know, add to his game. But I think what I think is the hallmark of Byfield, and I think a lot of other people would agree, is just how quick he is for somebody of his size, right? I mean, I joke about it, but I've seen it several times with OHL broadcasts, is that there's been examples where, you know, the camera crew can't keep up to him when he kind of comes into the frame. You know, they weren't maybe necessarily expecting that he would come in and intercept a pass, or he would, you know, grab the puck and just kind of go down the other end of the ice. And so I've gifted these several times, and it's like you just kind of see him come into the frame right at the end as he puts the puck into the net. So I mean, I think that's the greatest thing about him. And anytime you go to a game, no matter who they're playing or what's on the line that night, like he's always the most, I think, entertaining player to see on the ice on the Wolves team. And so, you know, I think with all of his skill and his offensive abilities, that as he gets bigger and kind of, I think, builds that confidence that he's, you know, going to need to make the transition to the NHL, like this is going to be, you know, a player who's going to be fun to watch, you know, for years to come. And so I think that, you know, people talk about how he didn't necessarily, you know, have a great showing, you know, on the international stage of the World Juniors. But again, you kind of think back to these, you know, these examples of previous years where people like, or players like Alexis Lafreniere, you know, didn't necessarily have a great year when he was 17 years
sure,
old.
Yeah.
And then the next year he came back, you know, bigger, stronger, a little more confidence, a little more experience under his belt. And, you know, he had a great tournament. And so I think, you know, looking at these small sample sizes is misleading sometimes. Again, when Byfield came back from the World Juniors, he lit it up for the Wolves until the season went on hiatus again. And so I think, you know, I think he's been a great addition to the team. Again, I'm not sure what depends on where he goes and what his future will be. I think it's kind of up in the air right now too, especially with, you know, the junior season not necessarily starting again, you know, until like, I think now we're looking at, you know, December potentially yeah. as to when they're targeting that. Right. And we've already seen players like Lafreniere say that he's going to turn pro. He's not going to go back, obviously. And that's a different story because he's, you know, a little further along in his development mm-hmm. with Byfield, but it'll be interesting to see where these guys end up, what the team's plans are for them in their development. And do they go back to junior in whatever format that is this year? So either way, again, I'd, you know, obviously as a Leafs fan, I wouldn't necessarily want him to go to the Senators, but they'd be getting a great player. I think ultimately, you know, this is the thing I've been talking about for the last, basically since I started writing for the Wolves and writing for the Kings, which is roughly around the same time, that I was just kind of hoping for this confluence where somehow the Kings could kind of bottom out enough to get a pick that would ultimately net them Quinton Byfield. And so we're pretty close to that being a possibility,
yeah.
But we'll have to see what happens in the next few months leading up to October and see what they actually do.
Yeah, and I think this is something that a lot of people can relate to, and if you're struggling with it, if you think about, you know, kids going to school, right? The depending on where you are born or what month you're born, you know, if you can be almost a year older than some of your classmates, and you know, it looks like, you know, maybe one kid's struggling. Well, he's not struggling. He's just 10 months younger than his, and that matters, right? When you're evaluating prospects. Austin Matthews was like 3 days away from being eligible for the Eichel, and you'll correct me, you probably have a better idea than that, but he wasn't far off that Eichel mm-hmm. McDavid draft, right? And so all of a sudden he goes from a guy who probably would have fallen in both behind both of those guys had he been a couple weeks older to the dominant pick in the next draft. And 1 year matters in a big way when you're talking about teenagers and their development and their size and strength and these sorts of things. Based on your observations of Quinton Byfield, do you see a potential down the road number one center? And if so, do you see more of a scoring guy, or is he more of a playmaking type player? Like, what can you tell us having seen him up close for a while now?
On it, he's got a lot of versatility. I think he could do both. And I think that one of the things is that, you know, people will say that, you know, given his size, you know, he's 6'4", you know, I think now at this point, he's probably like, you know, pushing 220, yeah. 230 or whatever it may be by the time he steps on the scales again, how like he's not necessarily a physical presence, but he does use his size to his advantage. Again, if you look at the way he kind of gets near, he uses his reach, he uses his big wingspan to make plays and turn the puck over and things like that. So, I mean, I think, you know, he definitely does, you know, I think kind of err more on the side of playmaking. But again, you know, he filled the net, you know, quite a few times this year. So I think he's got that versatility where, again, he can be a playmaker, but also he does have the, you know, the ability to put the puck in the back of the net. And I think, again, you know, the ceiling for a player like Byfield is ultimately, I think, hopefully to be a number one center for a team in the NHL. Hopefully that's the trajectory that he continues to go on, because certainly he's been, you know, he's been a revelation here in Sudbury. Again, I think that that's kind of one of the things that I think about for my past two seasons kind of working with the team, is that the club's been a little bit spoiled with some of the players that we've had come through. I mean, even with, you know, the goaltender last year, Ukko-Pekka Luukkonen,
yeah.
You know, that's another example of, you could argue that that was, you know, for the brief season that he was there. You know, you can make the case that that was probably one of the best, if not the best, goaltender to come through the Wolves, you know, in the club's history, right? And again, it spoke to how well he performed on the ice and how poorly the team performed when he was not on the ice. That again, you know, just how skilled and athletic he was, that he was a difference maker for the Wolves.
Yeah, those of us who only really catch junior hockey during the Christmas time, we remember that guy for sure.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So that was one of those moments where obviously I was torn with that, but it was great to see him, you know, come home, you know, with the gold medal around his neck. But yeah, it's just one of those things where, you know, I don't know how much longer we'll get to see Byfield in a Wolves uniform, but it's certainly been a treat watching him grow and develop and again become a, you know, a key part of the community as well. He's done a lot of great work with Neo Kids, the, you know, the regional children's hospital initiative that we have here as well. So I think that I think he recognizes that as he's, you know, I think becoming more of a prominent player, he has a role to play in giving back as well, which is great to see, you know, somebody at that age, you know, taking part in things like that and helping out.
Last thing on that then, do you think that he is ready and I mean, as you pointed out, we don't know, forget whether or not when junior hockey is going to start again. It looks like December. We don't know for sure when the NHL is going to start again. Do you think he's ready to step in and play next year in the NHL, or might he be a guy who benefits from another year of junior, or does it kind of depend on who picks him up and where he's going?
Yeah, I've thought about that quite a bit, actually. And I think ultimately it depends on who ends up picking him up and what their plans are, you know, for him in their system and where he fits into their system. But for me personally, I would think that he could use another year of seasoning in junior. But again, that's the answer I would have said to you 5 months ago before the shutdown happens. And right. So now you wonder, like, how are these guys going to be impacted by, you know, this different version of the season that we're going to have? Like, is it going to be... will it be detrimental to their development, or, you know, maybe it won't be, right? And so it's tough to say, but ultimately I would say that were we not living through this pandemic right now where everything's going to be different in the sporting world, you know, I would say that if everything being equal, that this was a guy who, again, had just turned 18 years old. There's certainly no rush, you know, I think, to bring him up into a team. Like, again, if you're looking at the Kings, certainly I can't, this is not going to be the year where they're going to flip the switch and all of a sudden be back into contention, right? So at that point, why rush your development? They've got such a stocked prospect system. So again, I think that you would kind of want him to really kind of reap the benefits of being able to play another year in junior and kind of ride off into the sunset with the Wolves, you know, ultimately going down as arguably the best player in franchise history.
I wonder, because I think you're right. I think... if it's not automatic, if you don't think for sure this guy's NHL ready, you're better off to defer to sending him back to junior. But I wonder, if he were to be drafted by Ottawa, he would be expected right away to do something. It's a Canadian market. They're thin up the middle. They would need to put him in almost to sell tickets, right? To build excitement for what this team is. Whereas if you were drafted by LA, even if they're not going to turn the corner, and Ottawa's not going to turn the corner this year either, but he could be sheltered a little bit by Kopitar and Carter and what they have. And I wonder if there's some value in that in terms of learning from those types of guys. And I think, you know, I know I've already referenced him here once, and at the risk of being Leaf centric, that was the ceiling. That's what people badly wanted Austin Matthews to be, was Anze Kopitar, right? If you could have some finish but be strong like that, be good in your own end. Do you think which team he goes to would play a factor into whether or not he's better off to go and learn from somebody or be left in junior? Or is it just player specific, this guy could use another year and let's leave him there?
I mean, again, I think all of those things are definitely contribute to what ends up happening to him. I think, you know, for me, still, I would say that regardless of who it is, whether it's Ottawa or another club that gets him and maybe has a more pressing need for him, you know, positionally or like from a marketability perspective, I would still want him to, you know, to get another year under his belt before kind of going up there.
Right.
But ultimately, I think that whether or not you keep him back for a year, you know, I think it is advantageous for him as in terms of his own personal development and his professional development that, you know, going to a club like LA where you kind of have, you know, somebody like Kopitar who, you know, kind of fits the same kind of mold as him, again, a big, you know, center down the middle who can kind of take him under his wing where he's not necessarily going to come into that role, you know, even if it's a year later, and expect to be the number one center, right? At that point, Kopitar will be, you know, 34 years old. So he's obviously getting up there. He's not necessarily the player he once was, but he's still, you know, a leader on that team. He's still contributing year in, year out. Again, he's led the Kings in scoring basically, you know, every year since he's come into the league. So certainly, I think, given his pedigree and what he's done with that club, and if Byfield ends up going to the Kings, you know, by some chance, and it works out that way, then I think that's a great system kind of set up where you've got that core that's still there and is on their way out to kind of bring up that next group of prospects and hopefully take what the Kings have been stockpiling over these years and really kind of transition them into becoming, you know, the next, you know, torchbearers for the club.
So Mike has a new project coming, and I want to talk about that. And we're also recording on the day that the Leafs made some news. I want to ask Mike about that a little bit. Before we do, I want to remind you to subscribe wherever you're listening to this one. As later this week, I'm going to be talking to Dan Schulman of ESPN, and of course the Blue Jays play-by-play team. We're really excited that he's going to be coming on the show. So that's going to drop in just a few days as well. So make sure you are subscribed to Tall Can Audio wherever you're listening to this one. Mike, there was some Leaf news today. I know you're a Leaf guy like I am. The Leafs deal, Kapanen and a couple of, you know, smaller pieces away for a first-round pick, a prospect in... you know, a Swedish kid right now, Filip Hollander, who was taken in the second round and is holding his own right now in the Swedish league, not yet 20 years old, so some value there. And a guy who will no doubt be part of the Marlies defense core moving forward. So just some stuff, but also cap space, right? And Evan Rodriguez also involved in that. At first blush, you know, we don't need to go terribly deep on it. What did you think of the deal? What did you think of Kapanen's time as a Leaf? And, you know, what was kind of your first reaction to what they did today?
Well, I think my first reaction, like a lot of people, was what's coming back the other way, right? Because again,
it was left hanging there, right? Like,
yeah, because I think it might've been Dreger who kicked it off, saying that, you know, hearing rumblings that, you know, Kapanen's going to Pittsburgh, and then Friedman, I think a few minutes later, confirmed that, you know, he was going to Pittsburgh and that trade was done, but there was still no indication of what was coming back.
Right? Bob would never do that to us, eh? This is like 2 minutes after Bob McKenzie retires. Bob would never left us hanging like that. Just being like, yeah, the Leafs are trading a guy and then going and taking lunch or whatever was happening.
Yeah, so then obviously you start to see the jokes start to fly through that, you know, Jack Johnson's coming back the other way. And then people are actually starting, as time goes on, it's like, wait a minute, is Jack Johnson actually coming back the other way?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh no, that can't be. Like, and so, and then like my chat group that I have for Leafs, my Leafs buddies, you know, they're actually, you know, thinking like Jack Johnson coming back is a good thing. A couple of them
No.
And I'm like, no, we don't have time to explain this right now, but let's hope that, you know, there's something else that's coming back. And so, I mean, admittedly, like again, with the prospects that are coming back the other way, I'm not going to pretend that I have a good, you know, understanding of who they are and what they'll bring and what their development looks like. But ultimately at first blush, I think, you know, being able to get that kind of value back, you know, for Kapanen at this stage, again, getting what I've read to be as a decent prospect, but also that first round pick.
Yep.
And then I think the other asset in this equation, which is cap space, you know, I think was a shrewd bit of maneuvering, on his part. Again, last year having to, you know, kind of wiggle out of the Marlowe contract by trading that first round pick, this kind of almost resets that a little bit. We moved down a couple spots from where that first round was, you know, last year, but ultimately kind of sweetener getting it back. You still get that, you know, that cap space flexibility, and then also get a prospect back by the same transaction. Right. So I think ultimately, you know, it's, I liked him when he was on the Leafs. I thought he was, you know, but I think after what we've seen happen, you know, this past season and in the last couple of seasons anyway, that obviously it was only a matter of time before these moves start to happen. It'll be interesting to see what happens now moving forward, who else kind of goes by the wayside. And ultimately, again, as part of the speculation that you see on Twitter with, you know, this, everyone's talking about cap space, and, you know, he's making some savings by moving out Kapanen. Is Dubas building up to something? And again, I'm sure there was probably more than a few people who were posting, you know, photos of Alex Pietrangelo. I know that there was a photo of him in my chat group today and people thinking about that, right? So certainly I think until we get to the, as the offseason continues and we get into free agency and all of that fun stuff in the fall, There's going to be, you know, no end of speculation as to what he's building towards, if he's building towards anything, or if this is just part of the retooling that we knew they had to do, you know, after this past campaign finished.
Yeah, I don't think I'm anywhere close to the first person to make the comparison between Kasperi Kapanen and Mike, I just completely blanked all of a sudden. Michael Grabner.
Oh, yes.
Who had the wheels, but just stone hands, right? And and you would see this happen all the time. And I loved Kapanen on the penalty kill, like the chaos that he could create and then rushing it out of the zone. And but at 5-on-5, it was almost always a fast, hard rush straight up the ice and then either right into the corner or stop up, wait for everybody to catch, and then now try and do something. And it got very predictable. It got... Speed is a weapon, but if you don't have the hands to back it up, and you know, he never looked good in the top six. He would always be throwing these like shin pad high passes to Tavares or Matthews that they could never quite, you know, bat down. And I think if you're going to make a move like this, this was the time while people are still in love with those wheels. And maybe, you know, he was only, I think he was at 13 goals when the break happened this year, so not on pace for great. I think he could do better with Malkin or Crosby. I think a lot of us could do okay with Malkin or Crosby. But he was sort of this guy that maybe was a lot of what they already had and not a ton of finish. And they've got Barabanov now under contract and Robertson coming. And if he's going to be kind of a 15 to 20 goal guy, I think they're confident they can find those 15 to 20 goals from someone else or other guys, but doing it a different way, right? Like Barabanov is supposed to be pretty good in terms of two-way. Obviously, Robertson is a big shooter, but as a young guy, he's going to be, you know, he's going to have his issues. He's going to be a little irresponsible here for a while, but cheaper, right? And I think that's kind of what they decided, was this guy was expendable at $3.2 million for another 2 years, and then he's still an RFA at the end of that. It's controllable. People love speed. I think this was... I don't think this is the last move that Dubas is going to make, but I'm not surprised it's the first. And even if all we got was the cap space, you know, not bad. The fact that you got a prospect as well and the first round pick, certainly at 15 in a deep draft, I kind of like it. We'll see what he does with it, but I kind of like what Dubas has done here.
Yeah, no, I'd say it was a great way, and it was to get that little bit of news in the morning. Again, at first I wasn't sure if I was maybe getting duped by a fake account, but I saw it. I'm like, no, this is actually happening. And yeah, I would echo everything you said, that I think it was, you know, a good move. Again, I think that it's part of a larger process that we're going to see unfold this offseason, but certainly I think off to a good start for sure. And it's definitely encouraging.
Let's get to the meat of it then, Mike. You have a new project coming. The last two times you've been on, we have talked about Hockey 365, daily stories from the ice, available now at your bookstore or on Amazon. What's next, Mike?
So we're doing Hockey 365, the second period.
Okay.
So it'll be the second book in this. Hopefully we'll end up now becoming a series now that there's two of them. So basically, we're going to... So the first book, you know, like you said, was 365 hockey history stories, one for every day of the year. I know that when I was writing that book, you know, there's obviously no shortage of hockey history that, you know, I felt like there was a lot of stories that I could have included, a lot of stories that I didn't include, a couple stories that I wrote but got the dates wrong that didn't get included because I already had another story that was on that day, so I kind of chucked it. But now we're working on the second one, so it's going to be out in the fall of 2021. Again, depending on how this next NHL season shakes out, that could be right before the start of the next NHL season, or it could be in the middle of the playoffs again, like we're kind of right now.
We have no idea.
But either way, it'll be right before Christmas of 2021, which is a great time to buy a hockey book for somebody you love. So either way, yeah. So it's been a lot of fun. I wasn't, you know, when I wrote the book the last time, it was a bit of a sprint to try to get it done in time. It's still going to be a sprint this time around, but to be honest, I'm really enjoying the process again. I'm probably, as of today, over 100 pages into the project. And so we're kind of coming up on that third of the way through mark, which feels great. Mm-hmm. So it's been a lot of fun to kind of pull in some stories that I didn't get to do the first time around, and kind of see where we can go. I've been trying to make an effort to to obviously keep them light, but also kind of bring in some more quirky or odd moments in NHL history that didn't necessarily have the first time around.
What's the balance like as you do something like this? How much of it is trying to keep an eye on? Obviously, you can't have an entire book of on this weird day in 2020, August 1st was the first ever August NHL game on whatever. How much of it is things that you thought were interesting from the first time around that you didn't get to use because you had something just a little more interesting from the first one? How much of it is research that you've done since, and how much of it is sort of, you know, just comes upon you as you're working your way through the general day to day? Like, what's the split like?
Yeah, so that's definitely something I've been mindful of right now, is that I don't want, you know, the entries in August and September to become just like a rehashing of the 2020 Stanley Cup playoffs.
Yeah.
But by the same token, it is obviously a very historic time because, you know, typically at that time of the year, all of the stories I had at that point are you're writing about trades and transactions. Mm-hmm. September is a little bit different because you start to get like things like the Summit Series or the World Cup of Hockey, which at least you can write about different games that were happening in that period, right? But
yeah.
But I will say that right now, I definitely do have a couple from, you know, this past month that I'm going to be putting in the book. But again, for good reason. I've got the Leafs win over the Blue Jackets when they came back somehow.
Yeah,
and actually won a game after trailing in the postseason. And I put that one in there because, again, what I've been trying to do with this book more than the last book. Again, there was one story in the last book where I included myself into the narrative when I talked about Austin Matthews' four-goal debut, because it was the first time that my daughter and I watched a hockey game together. She was born a couple weeks earlier.
That's awesome.
And so I figured that this time around, you know, I've kind of earned the right to, you know, it's my book, so I can kind of do what I want. But I've earned the right to kind of, I feel like when it's something that I could offer my perspective on, or I, you know, was have a vivid memory of the game that I hope I think is interesting, all included in there. And that's one. Again, I didn't watch that third period because, you know, as a Leafs fan who's been there before, I figured that after, you know, they're
over.
Down 3-0,
it's done.
Why am I going to watch this third period?
I was very much
so
the same way.
I shut it off. I watched, we watched an episode of Selling Sunset, you know, which is a great reality TV show if you haven't checked it out yet. and so I checked my phone, got the notification. I, of course, watched overtime on my computer while we continued watching Selling Sunset because I wasn't going to deprive myself of the opportunity to at least be heartbroken and sudden death. And I was very surprised. And so it was a great game. And then again, an example of like the Lightning Jackets, that first game that went to, you know, like quintuple overtime.
Yep.
That's one that's obviously historic in its own right. And I think ultimately just because of the fact that, you know, it happened in August, I think just makes it more noteworthy. But certainly it is about finding that balance. I know that other ways I'm trying to balance it out too is that, you know, in the 2 years since I wrote the first book, I've obviously done a lot more writing for the Kings. So I also don't want to necessarily use a lot of the material I've done with them over and over in this book, because again, I recognize the fact that not everybody is as interested in Kings history as I am.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have a couple Kings history stories in there that I think, you know, kind of stand on their own. But yeah, it is definitely a balance of making sure that I think my own, you know, allegiances for the Leafs, for the Kings, and for what's happening right now don't kind of trump things that have happened in the past that, you know, I think are merits inclusion on their own right.
It's so funny to hear you talk, like so many Leaf fans, like myself, this self-loathing defeatism. I'm getting texts from some of my friends who are Leaf fans, but also like my co-host who is a huge Senators fan, and really his second favorite team is whoever's playing the Leafs. And he's like, is this really happening? Is there coming back? And I'm not even looking up from my screen. Like, I still have the game on, but I've turned to my computer. I'm making notes for the upcoming show. I'm whatever. And I'm just like, no, don't even buy into it. They're just maximizing heartbreak, right? Like, we're just getting to 3-2, and then we're just going to die. And then they tie it, and I don't even, I'm just like, huh. Like, I didn't even yell. I'm not even excited. I'm just, again, going into overtime, you're just like, you're just going to make it hurt, aren't you? Like, this is.
Yeah.
And then they score to win it, and you're like, man. And then, of course, come out and do what they do in game five. But you're right. Like, it's such a. One of the best things I saw on Twitter, and I wish I could remember who posted it. And this is during the game where the Penguins got eliminated on August 7th, Sidney Crosby's birthday. Got to be the first time he's ever played a meaningful game on his birthday. And someone pointed out, I think it was one of the Penguins reporters, and there's a little video that Crosby took a moment at the end of that game as all the Penguins were going off to say something to each individual player. And I'm sure it was meant to be, you know, encouraging or whatever, but it was just in quotes over and over and over. You ruined my birthday. You ruined my birthday. You ruined my birthday. Any chance we get any Sidney Crosby birthday content in the new book, or you got something better trumped for August 7th?
Well, that would be, that's the Leafs game.
Oh, it is the Leaf game. You're right. Same day.
Yeah. So,
okay.
And I had
Sportsnet's worst nightmare.
Yeah. So I remember that day because I remember posting about Crosby's birthday, and that tweet somehow got a lot of play that day. I think a lot of people, myself included, thought there's no way that 87 is going to lose on 8-7.
Right.
So I was like calling it for sure. They extend the series tonight. And of course they didn't. And
no.
His birthday got ruined, but I kind of made a deal to myself that, you know, I didn't necessarily include birthdays in the first book, but I wasn't going to do it in this book. I did make an exception for Wayne Gretzky's birthday only because he did do some cool things on his birthday that I think were some notable milestones. So I have that in there, but it's kind of couched around the fact that he did all these other things on, you know, on his birthday. So it was a little easier to kind of do that. So I've tried not to do birthdays, trying to find more meaningful moments. You know, I had a couple deaths in the first book, which I'm steering away from this time around as well, trying to keep the book, you know, dealing with serious topics, but not necessarily dealing with things like birthdays and deaths. I think we can kind of focus our attention on other things that happen and kind of weave some of those stories in elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So no, there will not be a Crosby birthday in this one, though.
Fair enough. When you're writing the first one, when you finished it, did you know then, I've got enough here, there could be a second one? Like, was that already on your mind, or did that sort of come later?
It was, you know, it was definitely on my mind. I think given the fact that I've been, you know, tweeting out hockey history now for quite a few years, that I know how many tweets go out of my account daily. Not all of them are obviously bangers. There's a few that kind of just hang out there because, you know, it's a meaningless transaction or something that's not necessarily had a huge impact on, you know, the trajectory of either team,
sure,
depending on what the trade is. So I knew that not, you couldn't take every tweet I do and put that into a book because not everyone's going to want to read about, you know, Robert Lang getting signed that day or whatever it may be. Right. And again, no offense to Robert Lang. It was just the first name that I could think of in the moment. But I would say that for sure, it was definitely there. Again, I was not necessarily thinking, you know, that I'd write another one for sure. But I thought that, you know, if this was something that people enjoyed the first time around and the publisher was open to it, I would think that there's at least, you know, as I've been kind of going through this one now, knowing that I'm doing this a second time, I'm filing away dates for a third book, right? So that I, you know, when I go back and do this again, potentially, you know, you kind of have some material to work with, right? So you're kind of filing it away knowing that, hey, I can't include this one in this book, but if we were to do it again, you know, that's one for sure. Again, there's some where it has been kind of agonizing, where I'm thinking of, you know, there was one for me where, you know, when Mario Lemieux came back in 93, you know, he had just finished his last cancer treatment that morning. And then he went out and he played a road game in Philadelphia and he got this like, this really warm welcome from the Flyers fans, which is uncommon.
Santa doesn't get that. Santa gets booed in Philly. Mario got cheered somehow.
Yeah. Mario got a standing ovation. Right. So, but that was also the same day that, you know, Timo Solani, you know, threw his glove up in the air and pretended to shoot it. Right.
Hilarious.
So I really wanted to write about that one, but I'm like, you know, the Mario moment is a pretty, pretty touching moment in hockey history. So I decided to do the Mario moment and we'll do the Solani moment, you know, if there's a third book.
What's the process like in terms of, and maybe this is only for me, anyone who has to deal with me on a regular basis knows that I am extremely long-winded, and that's why I have a podcast. And but my emails are no different. My text messages are no different. I don't know how to shut it down. How do you find it difficult? Is there pressure to, there's a story I want to tell here, but I'm trying to keep this to kind of daily tidbits. I don't know whether people will take it all in one piece or whether they'll read it day by day. Do you find it difficult to condense the story you're trying to tell down into, you know, a brief kind of synopsis?
Yes. In a word, yes. I find that once you start to do it, like I'm in a rhythm now, like I know that each of these is 350 words. So I know that it's roughly, you know, two paragraphs And that's all you've got, right? Because the whole point of this book, especially this time around, is to keep them uniform. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the first book, there was a little bit of variation across the board. And I found that by the end of the book, you were probably getting more towards full-length stories. And if you go back into some of the earlier chapters, they're kind of all over the place. Because we did decide through the production phase of the first book that the concept of the first book was going to be like a bunch of longer chapters. So like a 5 or 6 page story about the Winnipeg Jets relocating. And then in between that one and another long one, you'd have these shorter ones that were significantly shorter.
Right.
And then as we kind of got on with it, we realized that, you know what, I think if we're really trying to market this as, you know, kind of a word of the day calendar type book, they should really be consistent across the board. And so we kind of got there with, none was over a page, but they weren't all one full page. Mm-hmm. This time I've been writing them exactly as if like every story goes down to the final line on the page and then the next story begins on the next line. And so I think it is difficult sometimes when like you're trying to tell a story in 350 words and you know there's a lot more nuance there that you're leaving out, but ultimately you can't keep writing because you're going to go on to the next page and defeat the whole purpose of the book.
Yeah.
So I just hope that, you know, I think that I've taken some liberties with some of the way the stories are told, knowing that you can't possibly do this whole person's life story in 350 words. And I think that given, you know, what the readers are hoping to get out of this book, again, it's not meant to be a comprehensive hockey history book. And so I think people understand that. And I'm just trying to tell it in a way that at least tries to get to the heart of the stories, but ultimately knowing that, you know, we're not going to be able to give you the entire, you know, synopsis of what happened that night and then what happened in the, you know, the 20 years after that person's NHL debut, for example. Right. So I think you've helped me kind of stream my consciousness in terms of when it comes time to write the introduction of the book and explaining some of that. But that's been the process so far.
Last one for you then, as we did the, like I said, it was last July that you were on last time, and I'll share the link to that as well at Tall Can Audio on Twitter and facebook.com/tallcanaudio if people want to go back and check that out. My assumption at the time was that the summer was going to be the hardest part of the book for you. And you at the time said that that wasn't the case because there's always enough, you know, the Gretzky trade happens over the summer. There's always free agency. There's, you know, the summit series. There's mm-hmm. things like this that happen that maybe you don't, the rest of us don't think of right away. And maybe the summer wasn't that difficult. I wonder, is there a time of year, is there kind of the dog days of January, February in most seasons where maybe not that much interesting happens, or over Christmas break? I mean, I guess you get the World Juniors. Is there a period in the calendar as you do this for a second time where you go, man, it's a little dry?
You know, I would say, obviously because I think we've actually talked about this before, and I think my answer was kind of similar, but I have a different perspective now that I'm like a couple years out from when we mm-hmm. first chatted about this, was that I kind of liked, you know, writing about those moments in the dog days of summer because it really freed you up, you know, to kind of talk about the player in more detail, right? And one example I use was, you know, in the first book I wrote about when the Hurricanes signed Artur Zerbe, the, you know, Latvian goaltender. And obviously, if all you're going to write about is like he got signed this day or got traded that day, there's not going to be a lot to write about, right? Because again, the transaction happened.
When he goes on to ruin Matt's fucking life in 2002 with his stupid gray rubber dude pads and his weird mask.
Yeah. So I didn't include that. But what I did include was, again, over the, you know, I talked about his, you know, some of his past struggles, you know, being in Vancouver and, you know, overcoming a dog bite injury to getting back and mm-hmm. becoming this dynamo, you know, with the Hurricanes. And so I kind of found it was a little freeing because you can kind of go off the board a bit and kind of say, you know what, this moment in history is about this particular free agent signing or trade. But let's talk about this other thing that happened in their life, or let's talk about this other game that happens, you know, years down the road as a result of that signing. And so, to be honest, I think sometimes during the regular season, like typically when we look at it, October to April, like oftentimes you're writing about this game and stuff. And sometimes I find that can get a little repetitive when you're talking about
somebody got 6 points or.
Yeah. Or this, something. The 50th goal of the season. Sure. Right. And so I've written about a lot of those because obviously, you know, you've got to kind of highlight those moments and let them speak for themselves. But yeah, I mean, in terms of, I think this time around, because we're able to kind of sprinkle in some of the stuff that'll happen inevitably in the, you know, in the 2020 playoffs, there'll be some of those moments. Again, there's a lot of, I think, cool offseason moments that I didn't deal with the first time around. I just think about, like, you know, the offer sheet with Shea Weber in 2012, like, yeah, things like that where, you know, we didn't necessarily get to, you know, look at it. I mean, even an example of, like, again, to pick on Sens fans is when, you know, Zibanejad getting traded to the Rangers in 2016, right? So mm-hmm. when I was writing the book, it was a year after that. And I think now I could probably assess that a little bit better than sure. I would have a year later, right? Because it's obviously turned out to be a boon for the Rangers. Mm-hmm. Doesn't look so great for Ottawa.
Right.
But so examples like that where I think as we kind of move away from some events that had happened maybe in the more recent past when I wrote the first book, now these are suddenly, I think, more ripe for analysis and inclusion into this book.
So the new book is on target for fall 2021. Mm-hmm. Tell the good people where we can find your work right now, what else you're doing, and how we can follow Mike Comito.
Yeah, for sure. So you could follow me on Twitter at Mike Comito. That's where you'll find daily moments in hockey history. And then once I'm back to business with the Kings and the Wolves, which is hopefully in the near future, that's where I post a lot of the stuff with them. So you can find stories there. But yeah, I would say for now, follow me on Twitter. That's where you'll get all updates about the book. And again, once I have, I think a more clear idea as to when it'll be released, I'll share that as well. But we're tentatively looking at I would think September of 2021, so that we can kind of maximize the marketing before Christmas and in the next NHL season.
Mike, you've always been a good supporter of ours. I think this is, like I said, the third time you've been on. Really appreciate it, and we will share all these links as they continue to become available. Certainly, the book, and maybe closer to release date, we can get you to come back on again.
Absolutely, I'd love that, Matt. Appreciate it.
This has been great. He is Mike Comito at Mike Comito on Twitter, and like I said, we will share all of that. All the info he just shared at Tall Can Audio on Twitter, facebook.com/TallCanAudio as well. For Mike Comito, my name is Matt Robinson, and this is all on the next one.
Now that's a tasty beverage.
Thanks for listening. You can get more TCA at TallCanAudio.com or by searching Tall Can Audio on your favorite podcast app.